This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
There's some opportunities to learn about careers in manufacturing these days and to be involved in what is called the Promise Grant Program, and it's being supported by the Calumet Area Industrial Commission. And with us to talk about it, we have the president and CEO of the commission, Ted Stalnos. Ted, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us first what the commission is all about, and in particular, how it's involved in this program. It helps offer up opportunities for people to learn about jobs and careers, for that matter, in manufacturing.
Well, the commission's mission for the last 51 years has been to promote and retain and attract manufacturing to the greater Calumet area, which includes the south side of Chicago, south suburbs, and northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And we're a membership organization first, so some of our better-known members are ArcelorMittal, Ford Motor, Sherwin-Williams, Kellogg's, and Norfolk Southern, CSX Railroad, and the like. And the idea is to make an environment that is attractive to businesses in the area and look to attract more and retain in this area. So we're a non-for-profit, we're nonpartisan, and the idea is to and workforce is a big item, obviously.
Yeah. Are we finding these days that were, of course, the jobs have been out there, we're finding more skilled jobs that are needed. We're seeing the change in of course, in technology that has to make the change. We've seen that, unfortunately, in the steel mills, where we had used to have thousands of people working in the steel mills, including the ones on the south side of Chicago, U.S. Steel, and the ones, of course, here in Gary and in East Chicago. And we're finding that technology has made it so that there are fewer people that have to run these operations. So we're finding that there are more people that are needed that are really, really skilled in whatever position they happen to be in, the craft that they're in?
And that's where we're focusing a large amount of our time and effort. And that's why we went after the Promise Grant, and which is a federal program with over $4 million worth of assets that are on both sides of the border. Equally, we serve people in both Indiana and Illinois. And it's based on getting people trained into careers in manufacturing. So it's a unique opportunity to help get people into advanced manufacturing, get their tuition paid, and probably most importantly, guide them into what advanced manufacturing is. Because there has been this tendency, probably more on my side, and when I say my side, we are just the other side of the Indiana border. My office is in the Pullman community, off the Bishop Ford. I happen to reside in Hagwish, so I can just about walk to Hammond. So we are just on the other side. This notion that everything's been offshored to either China or some other Pacific Rim country or to Mexico or some other place, and that's simply not true. United States Steel, I'll take Gary Works as an example, makes more steel than they ever have. And you're absolutely right when you describe it. At one time, Gary Works had 30,000 employees. Now, they have a few thousand people, but they make more steel than ever.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing with Arcelor, which is the old Inland and LTV and steel combined and the old Acme and so forth. But they make more steel than they ever have. But there's new procedures, and it takes a smarter worker, and it takes someone that has skills. Mm-hmm. So, and it's much safer now to work in these environments.
Yeah. What type of career paths in manufacturing are being offered that people can look into if they have the Promise Grant?
Well, there's several career pathways that folks can go into. There's the Steelworker of the Future program, both on the Indiana and Illinois side, and so let's say for, and I'll just focus on one where the electrical mechanical aspect of it, which, and Arcelor also has a presence in Illinois too. They have a facility in Riverdale, Illinois.
Right.
Besides the huge footprint they have in Burns Harbor and East Chicago and so forth. And by the way, I have 15 years in the steel industry myself, so, and a number of my staff did. So, but on that one in particular, if you were to learn high voltage, low voltage, programmable logic controllers, and let's say you could pick that up at Ivy Tech or at Prairie State or one of the other community colleges, perhaps while you were working and earning a paycheck, you would be talking about careers that are going to pay $100,000 a year with excellent benefits and an excellent future. And may I add, I've been taking care of dislocated workers since the industry contracted in the 80s. If you had that skill, you would have never been out of work, ever, ever, ever.
Wow.
So those particular skill sets have never had to look for work, even within the steel industry. So there are skill sets that even if there was no steel industry, which I expect the steel industry to last a long time, and flourish. That particular, and I could talk endlessly about steel, but their automotive, Ford Motor has 4,500 people just at Chicago Assembly. They just added over $1 billion investment here at the Southside Chicago plant, plus another almost 2,000 people at their Tier 1 suppliers surrounding that plant. They also have suppliers in Hammond, Lear Seating being one, and others that are within the area that supply Ford Motor. So there's an abundant amount of manufacturing in the Calumet area, and I can go on and on about manufacturing beyond auto and steel, plastic injection molding, and many, many, many others.
I guess it's really more of a having the qualifications as well as the skills for these advanced manufacturing jobs that if somebody has that, they could just about put an application in almost any place and have a good chance of having a very good, well-paying job, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we are having, I have more job openings, and we place people right into employment. We have an on-the-job training component. And we're looking for people now. We're having a hiring event at Finkelsteel, which is here on the south side of Chicago, and we're having that August 7th. And we're looking to hire. We're looking for full-time permanent positions, as an example. And we're going to be having that coming up. But we're always looking. We're always looking for some employer, and. So we just got done placing over 300 people at Flexengate, which is a Tier 1 supplier of Ford. And we were doing some for Tower Automotive, which is another Tier 1 supplier of Ford. So there's always an employer. Vesuvius is another one that in Chicago Heights that we were doing some hiring for. They were starting out at $18.40 an hour at entry level. You don't have to know a whole lot of basic reading and math, and they'll train you on the job, and we can assist with that. And so there's we would provide on-the-job training dollars to that company. So there's all sorts of opportunities out there in manufacturing at different levels. And for kids that are just graduating high school, we have bridge programs through the America's Promise Grant, and we can do it as a hybrid. We can send them off to school, pay for an associate's degree, or they can take classes kind of like a la carte while they're working full-time. We can place them into a job through maybe an on-the-job training opportunity while they're going to school and will pick up all the cost of their schooling. And in every book, pen, pencil, we'll pay for it.
Well, it sounds like there are great opportunities out there. You have to have the obviously the right skills, and that's what the Promise Grant program will help you be able to accomplish, to go back to school and get the training to be qualified for many of these jobs. If anybody's interested, number one, in finding out more about what the Promise Grant program is all about, and for that matter, two, to get involved with you folks in looking for these positions, how does somebody get a hold of the Calumet Area Industrial Commission to find out?
If they want to call our main number, it is at 773-928-6000, extension 260. We're also on Facebook. They could drop us a line that way, or we have a very long, we're on the web. It's at www.CalumetAreaIndustrial.com. That's a long one to remember. And drop us a line that way. Also, they know us at Ivy Tech and the reps because we're reimbursing people there. On the Illinois side, the community colleges, including Prairie State, Moraine Valley, we're all the way out in Joliet Junior College, we do reimbursement there. Also, Daly College in the city of Chicago, South Suburban College. So we're doing it multi-prong with that. So whatever community college an applicant were to choose, we don't try to sell one over the other. If somebody likes a welding program at Moraine Valley or at Daly College and they live in Hammond or in Gary, so be it. Mm-hmm. They could go that way. Or in if they like Prairie State, they can choose that. Conversely, if somebody's in, a lot of people in Chicago like Ivy Tech.
Right.
And Ivy Tech has got an agreement that they'll take someone from Illinois and under the Promise Grant, charge them the same tuition. So it's a wonderful thing for us.
Well, it sounds like, too, it's a great opportunity, as you've mentioned, for someone who maybe feels that they need more skills. And certainly we have workers that have gone through the process where they've been laid off in other jobs. They think that they might be qualified for some other type of career, but they don't have the skill set because they haven't gone to school. Here's our chance to be able to pick up the education, get the skills they need, and in turn make themselves available for some great jobs and set up that next career, I suppose, that's in the list to be sure. And that's where the Calumet Area Industrial Commission is going to be of really, really big help. We've been talking with Ted Stalnos. He's the president and CEO of the Calumet Area Industrial Commission. And Ted, thank you very much for telling us more about all the opportunities that the commission works out here in Northwest Indiana and in Illinois to get people into the right jobs and help supply these people to the manufacturers and companies out there. And for telling us in particular more about the Promise Grant program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for letting us spread the word. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Five extraordinary World War II bomber and fighter aircraft are coming back to Porter County, to the Porter County Regional Airport once again as part of the National Wings of Freedom Tour. And it's a special tour because we're going to be talking about a special reception that'll be coming up here as the aircraft come into Valparaiso. It's a special reception that's going to be held in support of first responders here in Northwest Indiana, and that means it involves the Mack Foundation. And Selena Weatherwax with the Mack Foundation is with us in the studio to talk about it. Selena, thank you for coming in, and welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit first, and from what you've been told by the folks that are actually bringing these planes in, what this year's crop, is, so to speak, is going to be like. They typically like to mix them up. They bring some of the regular ones in all the time, and we'll always, I guess maybe by popular demand, they want to see some of these come in from World War II, and then they always bring some different ones in. And you folks with the Mack Foundation get to have one especially involved with this reception. reception.
We do. The reception will be held on Saturday, August 3rd from 2 to 5 at the airport. And for that special reception, the Collins Foundation is working at bringing in a Hellcat, which was used during World War II. And so for those that come through the reception area in support of first responders, we'll have a firsthand look at what this beautiful aircraft looks like.
Now, I know that they've also put out the note here about the rest of the four that are going to be coming in, as I guess part of what the Valparaiso part of the tour is all about. What have they told you that they're going to be bringing in at the airport that people will get to check out as well?
Well, probably the most popular piece of aircraft that comes in as part of the tour is the P-51 Mustang. That mm-hmm. seems to be the one that people gravitate to. But in addition to that, a P-40 is also scheduled to land during that weekend, as well as a B-17 and a B-24 and a B-25. So it's five different pieces of aircraft that will be here landing on actually next week already.
I think it's remarkable that they not only have five aircraft that actually are flyable. They have to fly them in, obviously, to bring them in. So despite their age, 50-plus years, 60-plus years, even older, they're in perfect working order. These people with the Collins Foundation that set up this tour have worked so hard with all of the people that either are restoring these planes or have restored them and know how to fly them.
Absolutely. And then they also offer flights for the public. Yeah, there is an expense to it, but there is an opportunity for the public to actually ride in them. And Collins Foundation has set up this model that is very unique, but also one that they reference as a living history, a moving exhibit of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there's going to be a very special reception. That's where the Hellcat comes into play to be shown off at the airport in Valparaiso. Tell us what the reception's all about and the proceeds that are going to go toward.
The reception will be held in one of the hangars, specifically the McMillan Family Foundation headquarters. That's where our office is inside that hangar. Mm-hmm. And so inside the airplane hangar, we'll have food and beverages offered to those that come through and purchase tickets. And then we'll also have people driving tractors with wagons back and forth to these airplanes. So because this is an active airport, we certainly don't want people walking on the runway. And so we're offering transportation to and from these other five aircrafts that are going to be on site.
They push history very, very hard. I know with the Collins Foundation, and they're a nonprofit education organization. It's what they're designed to be able to do. But how do they tend to link together, in particular, with their visit here to Valparaiso to the first responders?
Well, that's a very good question. Bob Collins, Mr. Collins of the Collins Foundation, is mm-hmm. actually originally from Valparaiso. And so that's the local connection there. And we at the McMillan Family Foundation have been very supportive, specifically on the restoration of the P-51. And so because of that connection, they have been very generous in gifting us the tickets or the passes for our guests to go through this living history exhibit and in exchange allow us to raise some funds to support first responder training at the MAC.
Now, speaking of first responder training, that's what the MAC Foundation is best known for here with the operation in Valparaiso. And we've talked before on different occasions about the various facets of training, volunteer and professional firefighter training, for example. And I understand, too, that there is a new addition to the training facility there in Valparaiso that's going to involve canines. Tell us about that.
Yes, we have built a new canine training park. So these canine dogs are out there training with their handlers on a daily basis. There are no offset hours for the park, and so we have people that come on midnight shift even to train. So it's been really neat to see.
How long did it take to get this involved, to get this canine park involved? Because you're talking about having to plan ahead, certainly when you talk about training, and we know that the facility there in Valparaiso has been built over time to include all of the components together to be sure that firefighters and other law enforcement and first responders get trained properly. How long did it take to get the canine aspect trained?
That's a very good question, because we're very fast. When we first got word that the National Canine Conference was going to be held in Valparaiso, we got to work. And so we really pushed every limit possible to make sure that park was ready for when that conference was held, and that was held in the second week of June. Mm-hmm. So together, the planning, I would say, took maybe 6 months, but the actual execution or construction of took less than 3 weeks because of that tight timeline that we had to meet for that national group to come in.
What kind of facilities are out there and instances that the canines and their handlers have to go through to get the training that they need?
No, they do dogs, vehicle searches. They do drug detection. They even learn on how to find cadavers and body parts. I mean, the A to Z of training for canines is held there.
Wow. So the facility is now pretty much ready for any kind of training that police departments or sheriff's departments here in Northwest Indiana may need to take advantage of to get their canines ready to go out there and do the work that they do every day. And the handlers, for that matter, too, the police officers that are assigned to the dogs have to go through the same training, too. So they probably get their run through, too, I would imagine.
Oh, very much so, because it's very much a team sport between the handler and that canine. So working side by side and working along other teams as well as other dogs, other working dogs, is incredibly important. And so we're able to offer that environment for them to do so.
Now, you mentioned that the organization that puts together, I guess, the programs for training canines had just recently had their event there in Valparaiso. What kind of reaction have you gotten back from people that participated in it and what they think about the new the MAC Training Ground Park?
The first reaction, I think the most common reaction, I guess, is the wow factor. People have no idea what's happening at the MAC without seeing it. You know, they think they know, but until you set foot on that campus, that's when you really realize the magnitude or the scope of what we have led here. And so most of them were very surprised by it, and then most of them were also very excited to come back and use the campus for mm-hmm. their training. And these are folks from all over the country.
We've talked about the various training facilities there that MAC Foundation has created over time there in Valparaiso, and a lot of the training we mentioned here at the beginning of our conversation dealt with training firefighters, whether they're volunteers or whether they're professional firefighters, to get them ready. A lot of it, I know, has to do with the training that they get, I guess, in addition to whatever training that they have when they go back to their respective fire departments. What kind of training the fire departments have to go through now? Fire departments, I know, used to have their own training academies, or used to have something was set up, especially bigger cities. And I know you've probably taken over a lot of those duties, and for a lot of small fire departments that couldn't afford to have such a facility.
That's exactly it. So what we were seeing is that there was a difference in experience because of that, right? A department that was leading their own training, and they still have to do quite a bit of that anyways, but for them to lead an academy is really unfeasible. It's mm-hmm. just, it doesn't make any economic sense to do so. And so by us offering the classes where they're all invited to come through the MAC, one facility, we offer the infrastructure. Not only is it a significant cost savings for departments, but an obvious cost savings to taxpayers and municipalities as well.
Now, getting back to the event coming up here on Saturday, August 3rd, at the airport, involving, of course, the World War II aircraft and the very special reception that's going to be held there with the MAC. If anybody's interested in attending in this and like to get some of these commander passes, as they're called, how can they find out more?
Well, I would encourage them to call here, Lakeshore Public Media, because you are one of our generous sponsors, but also the MAC Foundation, a website. It's MAACFoundation.com. And on the website, the main page has a link, and people could order their tickets online, or they could call us as well.
Selena, thank you for coming by today and telling us all about this. And we hope that the big event coming up on Saturday the 3rd is very successful.
Thank you, Chris.
And that's Selena Weatherwax. She's with the MAC Foundation based in Valparaiso. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking. The city of Gary has had issues in the past over how the combined storm and sanitary sewer overflows have been working in the city. Ended up going to court and some matters taken care of there. We'll find out more. And now we also know, too, that the city of Gary is working on a sewer overflow long-term control plan. And for that, let's turn now to Dan Vicari. He's the executive director of the Gary Sanitary District. Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
So thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, start, if you will, please. Give us a little history about the combined sewer overflow issues in the city of Gary that have kind of led up to where you are now, actually, at this point with this work that's underway on a long-term control plan.
The city of Gary, like many larger urban areas in the Midwest, has what we call combined sewers. So the sanitary waste and stormwater are combined into one large sewer that's conveyed to our wastewater treatment plant. When we have less frequent but more intense rainfall, the results could be overflows at designated points throughout the city. And those overflows go to both the Grand Calumet River and the Little Calumet River. We have 11 of those overflow points in total. And we average in the worst areas along the Little Calumet River, it can happen about 20 times a year. Mm-hmm. So we are working with the state and federal government to develop a plan to minimize the occurrence of those overflows and their impact to water quality in both the Little Calumet and Grand Calumet rivers.
Now, we know that probably didn't happen under your watch, so to speak, but how did the problems get to the point that we end up getting the federal government, the Department of Justice, and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management involved? What's the consent decree all about?
Most big cities that have combined sewers and need to develop a long-term control plan are under federal consent orders mm-hmm. or state agreed orders to develop those plans and implement the recommended plan. The case in Gary, these sewers are mostly, they've been there, many of them, for nearly 100 years. So this is not a new problem. And really, it's not necessarily a problem. In a lot of cases, a well-managed and well-maintained combined sewer system can actually benefit overall water quality in our rivers. And where I'm going with that is if you have separate sanitary and separate storm sewers in a newer community, every drop of water that runs off of paved areas, lawns, vacant areas, all ends up in the receiving waters. So in the case here in Gary is that we at least can capture those more frequent but less intense rains and treat all that storm water at our wastewater plant. And by the way, our wastewater treatment plant is the largest in the region. It's rated at 120 million gallons a day. We've been working for several years trying to tweak the plant to treat more and more water. And we actually, this year, in this last 12-month period, we've had a number of records broken at the plant, both for highest flow rate at any moment. We were roughly 152 MGD. MGD is million gallons a day. Mm-hmm. And this last May was a very wet period, as we all know, and we treated on an average month more flow than we ever have before, and it was roughly 90 million gallons in an entire month on the average. Pretty incredible numbers, and all that water is coming to our wastewater treatment plant, which does a fantastic job creating a high-quality effluent that exceeds our permit limits on a daily basis.
I understand then that, of course, the challenges of all that rain is probably kind of maybe as that sometimes might have overtaxed the system, and that's why they had the overflows?
That's right. That's why those overflows are there. They're there to protect both flooding. They're there to protect from the incidence of basement backups.
We've had a recent meeting happen on July 11th. It was a public meeting to talk about a lot of this in particular. And I'll ask if you'll give us an idea. I know it may still be in the works, but what the long-term control plan is all about. What elements does it include that will try to address the issues of the overflow system as it is and to make improvements so that there won't be any big problems where some material will end up getting into the lakes and in Lake Michigan in particular and into the rivers?
Really, it comes down to there's just a few basic things that can be looked at in a variety of ways. One is you can separate your sewers, and I just spoke of the pros and the cons of that. You can also add offline storage, so it could be a large storage basin throughout at key points throughout the city to temporarily store those overflows until a time when the sewer system is not as taxed, and you can bleed that flow back into the system. There's also looking at improved capacity at your wastewater treatment plant. So you take these different sort of types of options and you develop and combine them into alternatives. So where we're at right now is we've developed computer models of both the sewer system and of the rivers that can then take and simulate combined sewer overflows as a result of rainfall, and then how those overflows impact water quality in the Little Calumet and Grand Calumet rivers. So all that legwork, developing those models, characterizing the system, and how often we have combined sewers on an average annual basis, what those impacts are to both rivers. And we have sent those reports to EPA and IDEM, and they have accepted those models for use to develop alternatives for the long-term control plan. So that's where we are right now. We're developing alternatives. So we had this meeting on July 11th to inform the general public on why we have to do a long-term control plan, what is the current state of affairs, namely what is the water quality like in Little Calumet and Grand Calumet River, and how do combined sewer overflows contribute to water quality impacts. And then we talk about the various different alternatives and what types of things we'll be looking at. We'll submit our alternatives analysis, it's called, to the EPA and IDEM here next month and get their feedback prior to going back to the public and discussing the different alternatives and their associated costs with the public.
At this meeting on the 11th, did you have any comment from residents, businesses, and alike industries that they might have concerns or questions about what you've done so far and what everything is like?
Yeah, we did. We had a lot of positive comments, people really looking to see as we redevelop the city of Gary that we do so maximizing the use of green infrastructure. Green infrastructure is could be a variety of things, but basically it's an attempt to try to mimic natural processes. So instead of having what's typically called gray infrastructure, which is pavement and pipes and tanks, you're trying to use materials that will mimic the absorption of rainfall back into the ground. The benefits there is it obviously is a less burden on your sewer system and your wastewater treatment plant, and it also recharges local water supplies. So that is something that will be incorporated into our long-term control plan. But just like any of the different options available for the mitigation of the overflows, not one of these sort of technologies is going to solve all the problems. It'll be a variety of different things. And over a number of years, EPA typically will give you 25 or more years to implement these plans. There's projects we've been working on to move toward the goals of the long-term control plan prior to the developing and negotiating that plan with the EPA. For example, the Lake Street Business District in the Miller section of Gary is an area that we have utilized green infrastructure to basically remove all stormwater inputs to the combined sewer system, and we're infiltrating all the stormwater on Lake Street back into the ground.
Okay.
So we started that work last summer for all the sewer work. Rework, rather. We spent $4.5 million last year removing all the stormwater inputs from the combined sewer system. And then this year, we're spending about another $4.5 million on a re-streetscaping of the Lake Street Business District.
I was going to say, it must take a certain amount of time, and you have costs and all that are involved in that. When it's time to actually put together information, and maybe you've had a chance in some of the work already and what's going to be coming ahead as well that you'll have to bring up before EPA and IDEM about this, what kind of general costs are we talking about here to be able to do some of the things, at least some of the, maybe not all the alternatives, but some of the things that you would like to do to be able to improve the system?
Yeah, there's ongoing operation and maintenance of our system, which is already a pretty high burden to our residents with respect to the cost of service and maintaining current state of affairs. What we're looking at in the long-term control plan, and again, these are very rough and draft numbers that we haven't discussed with the EPA, but on the order of $250 million over 30 years is something that is probably within the realm of what we're talking about. We'll be having those conversations both with IDEM, EPA, and the general public for buy-in before we would ever sign on to any particular plan.
When you're talking about such an expense like that, even stretched out over decades, it's still, is that pretty much in line with what sometimes it typically would cost to be able to do this kind of long-term control plan?
Yeah, that's not atypical, Chris. What we also need to look at is the affordability of the plan, mainly the affordability of our customers, which are mainly the residents of the city of Gary. EPA has guidance documents that are used nationally for what would be considered a high burden on the affordability to customers.
Along with the cost and all that's involved, of course, to residents, which are going to determine over time, what kind of costs do businesses and industry in Gary have to share of all of this?
Well, everyone shares equally based on their usage of water. So whether you're industry, you're a business owner or a homeowner, your sewer bills are based on your water consumption.
What kind of timetable, if you have one set up already, now that you're in the process of doing the work on the long-term control plan, how soon do you hope to have some of these elements together to be able not only to present to the public, but also to present to the utility regulators?
We hope to have feedback from EPA within 90 days after our August submittal of our alternatives analysis report. Once we get their feedback, there's likely to be some edits and revisions based on their comments. And at that point, we'll be able to go back to the general public and present the alternatives and a recommended plan.
Do you feel confident that things are going to be able to move ahead like you like?
I do. I feel very confident that we'll be able to find an affordable plan that addresses citizens' concerns, that addresses water quality concerns in both the Little Calumet and Grand Calumet River, and has buy-in from the federal and state agencies.
Well, Dan, it sounds like you're well on your way as representing the Gary Sanitary District, along with the other agencies that you're going to be working with EPA and with IDEM in particular, to try to resolve some of the historic problems, get them resolved with some new technology, and certainly a new green technology, it sounds like, since you'd like to have more green infrastructure set up out there. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today, and we hope to hear back soon and to keep track of some of the progress that's being made on the combined storm and sanitary sewer overflow long-term plan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Dan Vicari is the executive director of the Gary Sanitary District. Abortion has been in the public debate across the Midwest states in recent months. Indiana, Ohio, Missouri, and other states have passed laws to restrict abortions, and court challenges have followed. But the public debate often doesn't include people who have had abortions themselves. To open a two-part series of these personal stories, Side Effects Public Media's Paige Flager visits an abortion clinic near Dayton, Ohio. And by the way, some listeners may find some of the content in the reports a little disturbing.
Yes, this is the spot.
Marilyn Evans stands in an empty parking lot, looking at a nondescript office building. The Women's Med Center in Kettering is the only abortion clinic for miles. Now, it's embroiled in a legal battle to stay open.
You think with certain human rights that people move forward, but as we've seen, you know, over the course of the last few years, you know, we're in unbelievable ways moving backwards from things that in my lifetime, I thought were done deal.
Evans has been here before, first in 1996. She decided to get an abortion after finding out there were complications with her pregnancy.
It just seemed like the right decision, and it was the right decision for my husband, and it was the right decision for, I mean, like I said, I had a little kid at the time. I had a four-year-old, and, you know, I worked, and it didn't seem like I would be able to take care of a kid with special needs.
She was steadfast in her decision, but she says it was still hard to talk to other people about what happened.
You know, women aren't comfortable when they have miscarriages, let alone nobody. I mean, nobody wants to talk about losing a baby, period, because it's so physical and so emotional and so personal that, you know, you are really holding your breath until you actually have a healthy baby in your arms.
Her oldest daughter, Macy, remembers her mom being open and honest with her from a young age.
So right away, my mom was already having conversations with me about sex and birth control and abortion and just periods and things like that. And so that always kind of led my friends to always asking me questions and asking my mom questions. And we were kind of just like that open household to talk about things.
It wasn't until she heard people talking about abortion at school that she realized it was a divisive topic.
In high school, when people started to put kind of a negative connotation towards abortion, I always kind of stood up and said that I didn't agree with that. And especially in my mind, I was like, my mom's had one. Like, I would hear people at school talking about how it was a bad thing or a terrible thing or a murder, and I literally knew my mom had had one.
But that got harder when Macy turned 17 and got pregnant. She said she was on birth control and her boyfriend used a condom. She told her mom and got a pregnancy test.
And we just sat there and looked at it. I knew 100% it was going to be positive. And my mom just like gasped and we both like cried a lot.
Macy decided she wanted to have an abortion. Her mom drove her to the same Kettering clinic where she'd had her abortion decades earlier. Macy says the worst part was facing protesters outside.
I will never forget the people screaming in my face, you know, calling me a murderer. And I mean, that's the most unpleasant part.
She had already surpassed the 6-week mark when she had the abortion. A recently passed Ohio law known as the Heartbeat Bill bans abortions after that mark.
My life literally would have been completely different, and it wouldn't be the life that I wanted for myself. And it's weird. Like, it's just a weird thing to think about that my mom got hers so long ago, and that then I got mine almost 10 years ago, and that now it's going to be different.
Outside the clinic, Marilyn Evans points to a sign of that change. The building across the street is a pregnancy center run by a religious organization. These kinds of centers steer women away from abortion. The window facing the abortion clinic advertises pre-termination consultation.
Now that I know those things exist, I'm like furious, but because you wonder how many women have been tricked by it.
Women and families bustle in and out of the building. While the abortion clinic lot is empty, the lot across the street is full. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a woman who turned to a religious organization after an abortion and now encourages women to find other alternatives. There's been a lot of attention given to online browsing habits and how they can be used by companies like Google and Amazon to target you with ads. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks tells us, one Indiana startup is now using the same techniques to try to help solve Indiana's brain drain problem.
On Purdue University's campus, graduates in caps and gowns are lined up, waiting to take a picture under the school's iconic arch. Ali Musser is there with her parents a day before graduating.
Oh my goodness. I'm scared. I'm excited. It's all there, all the feelings.
Musser got a job in Dallas, and although she's from Indiana, she says she can't wait to leave.
For me to come back to Indiana, it'd take a lot better weather and a definite pay raise on that.
Indiana struggles to retain highly skilled college graduates like Musser. Last year, Purdue and Indiana University Bloomington both estimated the majority of their graduates left the state. Notre Dame reported closer to 90% left. Adding to that, a congressional study published this year placed Indiana among the 10 worst states for losing highly educated workers. Timothy Zimmer is an economist at the University of Indianapolis. He says while it's great that the state produces so many college graduates, it's a bad sign that it can't retain them.
It would be like the state going out and investing and buying all this high-tech equipment and then turning around and sending all this high-tech equipment to other states.
To combat this, Indiana's launched a brain gain initiative out of Purdue, started by a former governor, and even a new law requiring state colleges to market Indiana jobs to students. But in the past year, one Indiana startup decided to take on that challenge with a very 21st century approach.
Hi, good morning. Is this Ashley?
Yes, this is Ed.
Yes, it is. Hey, Ashley, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for taking my call today.
That's Ed Sherman, VP of Talent Development and Talent Mapping, or simply TMAP. He's demonstrating with a coworker on the phone line how they reach out to potential job candidates and to see what it would take to get them to move to Indiana.
If I had to sum up what TMAP does in one sentence, our goal is to grow the Indiana economy.
Those phone calls aren't random. Sherman is pulling from a list of people TMAP generates after they scrape social media profiles and buy databases of information to find people with ties to Indiana. TMAP was started by Bill Osterly, the founder of another company made possible by the internet called Angie's List. He says the little online breadcrumbs we create when surfing the web can be used to target marketing for Indiana jobs.
Are they originally from the place? Do they go to Colts games? Do they talk about Indiana on Twitter? In a nutshell, the World Wide Web is a wonderful place to go get information about people.
Vanessa Raminski is one of the first job candidates TMAP found. She's from LaPorte and graduated from Indiana University, but for the past 15 years, she'd been living and working in Wisconsin as a buyer for a corporate retailer.
I actually thought for sure that there would be no opportunities for me that I would come back for.
When the company she worked at closed, she was referred to TMAP. Based on her career goals, they paired her with a startup in Indianapolis that helps retailers sell products on Amazon.
I mean, it was really exciting, and it was something that, wow, if that worked out, that would be kind of check a lot of our boxes. I wanted to really refocus my career on the future of retail, and it's great to be closer to family and friends.
And work out it did. Vanessa was one of about 40 people TMAP brought back to Indiana in its first year. Osterly says he hopes that with increased cooperation between TMAP, universities, and lawmakers, they can guide more graduates into Indiana jobs. With all their efforts combined, maybe, just maybe, Indiana can put a stopper in the brain drain. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
It's time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is John Biancardi, who is a member of the board of directors at the Cesare Battisti Lodge. And is that, do you guys operate Villa Cesare in Charleville?
Yep, it's a not-for-profit. We own and operate Villa Cesare, which is a banquet hall reception for special events and stuff like that. But mostly it was built for a community center for our club and then also to keep the place running. We have the receptions and stuff like that.
So we're going to talk about your Festa Italiana, which, of which you are the chairman.
Correct.
But first of all, tell us a little bit about Cesare Battisti Lodge.
Yeah, so it's actually been around for 100 years. We're celebrating our 100th anniversary. It started in 1919. So back in the day when Italians immigrated here from Italy and came to this area from Ellis Island, they came here for skilled jobs, labor jobs, boiler makers, steel mills. And Italians stuck together. They barely spoke any English, and a few small group of Italians got together, formed this lodge, and it was at a small little center in East Chicago, and they played Italian games, Italian music, and got families together and had fraternal benefits. It grew as the years came out, and they rented a bigger hall in East Chicago, and then in 1989, the organization built Villa Cesare in Charleville. And
it's been there that long.
Yeah, 30 years.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That's as long as the Art Center in Munster's been around,
too. Wow. Yeah, it was one of the first, actually, reception areas in the area, but now there's been quite a few that have been built recently in the last decades. But, yeah, before the Home Depot or Menards was up there, you could see it right from 41.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. I didn't realize it was 30 years. Okay, so how long have you all been doing the Festa Italiana?
Yeah, it started in 2017 was our inaugural fest, and we noticed that there was a need for an Italian fest in Syria. We saw Greek festivals, Serbian festivals, Polish festivals, Hispanic festivals, and we have the only Italian organization in this area. Why not create an event for an Italian fest? So we had the thought for a few years before, but just didn't really have our buns lined up. So in 2016, we started planning, and then 2017, we actually executed our first fest.
And is it held on the adjacent to the
Yeah, so it's in our parking lot there. We have a fairly large parking lot.
Okay.
So we use half of it for the fest, half for parking, and then the local neighborhoods and businesses for additional parking.
So you've been drawing a good crowd?
Yeah, the first year it was actually really tough to get food vendors to commit because it was the first ever fest. They didn't know if they were going to be profitable or if they had the time or resources to do it. So the first fest, we actually only had four food vendors, but we had all Italian food. We had amazing Italian entertainment, but the crowd was overwhelming. All our food vendors ran out of food before the nighttime.
Oh, great.
So the next year, it was a lot easier to get restaurants. So last year, our second year, we had about 10 food restaurants, which is probably the most I'll ever do, considering our area and our space.
Mm-hmm. So how many, what kind of acts or what kind of activities go or take place at the fest?
Yeah, so I try to keep it really as Italian as I can. We have traditional Italian music where we have some entertainers that some don't even speak English that perform all in Italian, and you'll get some music that you'll hear in Italy in different dialects and different regions. And you also have some local artists that do Italian American or third, fourth generation, so they'll do some really famous Italian American artists like Dean Martin and stuff like that.
That's great.
And then we also, we have a culinary exhibit inside. We have a celebrity chef. He's a younger chef, and he specializes in Italian specialties. So we're doing that Friday and Sunday and have three total sessions where He's going to have a class of a max 25. He's bringing individual pasta-making machines for each person that attends, and he's going to do a three-course meal of how to make three different pastas from scratch,
uh-huh.
and then they're going to cook it and enjoy it.
That sounds fun. And I see you have a spaghetti eating contest.
Yeah, that's one of our highlights. It's kids, adults. You give them a bowl of spaghetti, all the same amount, with uh-huh. sauce in it, uh-huh. hands-free.
Hands-free?
Yep. You put your face in the bowl, and whoever eats it in the fastest time wins. And the kids love it. The adults love it. And it's a very, very fun time.
And the grape stomping contest.
Yeah, so we added that last year. And if you can remember the I Love Lucy.
Oh, I can well remember.
Yeah, episode where she's stomping on a big grape. So imagine that. It's like a relay team. You go for a minute, tag your partner, go for a minute, uh-huh. tag another partner, and go for a minute. So there's 3 minutes total, three people, and whoever can make the most juice out of that grape stomping contest wins prizes. So it's pretty unique.
So, John, have you been the chair the whole time?
Yeah, so I came up with the idea, and what I did in the first year is I went around other festival chairmen
uh-huh.
and tried to ask them, like, what do I need as far as permits, space, electricity, right. and kind of pick everyone's brain, and then from there, the activities I tried to align with our Italian roots, and from an outsider's perspective, the first fest went great.
Yeah.
There was some internal stuff behind the scenes where we might have not buttoned up all the way, or we were fussing with each other, but that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And the second year was even better, so I think this year, hopefully, it's going to be kind of flawless.
Well, congratulations! You're a young guy. I commend you for. for doing it, taking the initiative.
I appreciate it. I have a lot of pride in my last name, a lot of pride in my Italian history. So anything to make my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents proud, that's why I do it.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation with John Biancardi and John Kane also online, too, and all the other conversations on Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can tune in again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. This program note, on Wednesday, we will not have a Regionally Speaking program. That's because we will be carrying the live coverage of the conversations that Robert Mueller will have on Capitol Hill. That's conversation that's going to begin with special coverage from NPR on Wednesday morning at 7:30. So we won't have Regionally Speaking for you on Wednesday. And we hope, though, you'll join us for Regionally Speaking tomorrow.